Good morning. Emotional messages and a controversy over Melania Trump's speech mark the first day of the GOP convention. Neil Conan gives us his analysis of the day and the day since the attempted coup in Turkey. Could the U.S. be on its way to another housing meltdown? We'll talk with RealtyTrack's Darren Blomquist about the red flag he sees on the mainland and its implications for Hawaii. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. What are the lessons we can learn from pre-contact settlements in our islands? A visiting archaeologist is studying a settlement on Kauai's Napali coast that goes back to the 13th century. And just what are the lessons of island life? Most of us would agree that it can change us, but how exactly? Kauai author Jason Blake's new book offers some answers.
That's the conversation for Tuesday, July 19th. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. A roll call of states takes place on the second night of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Delegates will formally declare celebrity real estate mogul Donald Trump the GOP's presidential nominee and his evangelical Christian running mate, Indiana Governor Mike Pence, the vice presidential nominee. Governor Pence is not scheduled to take the stage at the convention until tomorrow, but the audience of the American Conservative Union Foundation in Cleveland got a glimpse when Pence compared Trump to a political icon of the GOP, as heard on CNN.
I have a sense of this man. I have a sense of his heart. I have a sense of his hands-on style of leadership. And for all the world, he reminds me of Ronald Reagan.
The Trump campaign is still trying to manage the fallout of allegations of plagiarism surrounding Melania Trump's speech, portions of which bore striking resemblance to a speech First Lady Michelle Obama gave about her husband during the Democratic National Convention in 2008. Criticism about Mrs. Trump's remarks are prompting a mea culpa from the Department of Justice after a staffer tweeted an inappropriate comment about the former model from the agency's official account. NPR's Carrie Johnson says the Justice Department is pledging to tighten its social media process.
Authorities say the critical tweet about Melania Trump was intended to be sent out from the staff member's personal account. Instead, it went out to the agency's entire group of more than 1 million followers before it was deleted. The Justice Department says the unnamed public affairs staffer has now been banished from using the department's Twitter handle. The agency says it will offer more social media training and impose new procedures for using Twitter. A justice spokesman says the message about Melania Trump does not represent the views of the department, and they're working to make sure nothing like this happens in the future. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
In northern Syria, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says 56 civilians have been killed in airstrikes carried out by the U.S.-led coalition in the past day. NPR's Allison Muse reports the coalition is reviewing the latest allegation.
The Syrian Observatory says at least 11 minors were among the victims. The alleged attack occurred north of the town of Minbij, where U.S.-backed Kurdish and allied Arab forces are pressing gains against ISIS. A Pentagon spokesman tells NPR the coalition is reviewing how close U.S. airstrikes were to the location in question. The UN estimates 70,000 civilians are trapped in Minbij. The town and neighboring areas face near daily coalition strikes. The UN human rights chief says those who flee also risk being killed by ISIS landmines. Allison News, NPR News, Beirut.
U.S. stocks are lower, with the Dow off 10 at 18,523. NASDAQ is off 25 at 5,030. S&P 500 also down at 2162. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from organizations. Other contributors include Visiting Angels, professional caregivers assisting adults in bathing, dressing, meals, and light housework nationwide. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Office locations are at visitingangels.com.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
You know, the housing market was once seen as pretty much rock solid, right?
Well, we got a bit of a lesson in that not
that we
too
did.
Long ago.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been 9 years since the Great Recession. Many analysts said that the biggest failure was not paying attention to what was happening in the housing sector. Come on, you remember the slicing and dicing of subprime mortgages, the credit swaps and other derivatives. Now, while those products have gone away, mostly, the concern over how much third-party buyers are taking a chunk of the housing market is again becoming an issue, according to Darren Blomquist, Senior Vice President of Realty Track. We talked earlier, and I asked about the warning signs he sees on the mainland and how they compare to Hawaii data.
In some ways, when we look at looking at the data in Hawaii, there are some concerns there because the prices have just gone up so dramatically over the past four and a half years. We've seen, I was looking statewide in Hawaii, there have been 51 consecutive months of year-over-year increases in home prices, median home prices. And as of April of this year, the median home price across all the markets in Hawaii hit a new all-time high that we've ever seen of $483,000. But then when we look at some of the key red flags in the market, people who are speculating, and those tend to be people buying at the foreclosure auction, there's not as much of a concern in Hawaii. Nationwide, we're showing 31% of all properties being sold at the foreclosure auction are going to investors, which is an all-time high since we've been tracking this going back to 2000. In Hawaii, it's only at 18%, so there's not as high a percentage going to the investors.
Particularly on the high end, anything that would be a million and up. Do you have any particular concerns about acquisitions of those by third parties and people thinking that they're going to be able to get a good deal before we hit a real downturn?
That market is just more fickle. And on top of that, in Hawaii, you have a market that's not just high-end, but tends to be more a second home, vacation home type of buyer. And that's going to be a more fickle buyer as well, who, given any change or minor shock sometimes to the economy, that's going to be the kind of buyer who's going to pull back the quickest, the high-end buyer, and as well as the second home buyer. One thing that is surprising is in the three counties that we track, Maui, Honolulu, and Hawaii County, we look at historic affordability in each market. And all three markets, homes are still more affordable than they have been historically on average, which may be surprising because we've hit a new all-time high in home prices.
Yeah, a lot of people are going to be hearing that and thinking, what?
That doesn't make sense. And yes, and to use the word affordable maybe and Hawaii in the same sentence might be a little bit seems strange, but what is keeping things more affordable than you might think, especially given these eye-popping home prices, is interest rates. And that's actually a concern in and of itself, is that these super low interest rates that we've been seeing that just seem to keep going down are actually allowing people to afford more home than you might think.
That also, though, sounds as if that could be a real warning for what could happen if people bite off more than they can chew. And we find ourselves in a very similar situation to what happened, you know, 8-9 years ago.
Exactly, yeah. So it's a slightly different flavor of what we were seeing inflating the bubble 10 years ago, but there are definitely some earmarks that are similar. The differences are that we're not seeing a lot of what we would describe as toxic or creative loans that allow people to buy more than they can really, truly afford. But these interest rates are giving probably a false sense of affordability, and especially if people are using loans that are adjustable rate, that could be a shock for people down the road if interest rates go up. The somewhat ironic piece of what we're seeing these days is if you're a real estate investor, if you're buying a home that you're not living in, it's actually in many ways easier to qualify for a loan than if you are buying a home to live in.
Why is that?
Well, the reason is that in part because interest rates are so low, there's a lot of capital out there looking for return. And a lot of this capital in the form of Wall Street hedge funds and private equity firms is actually going to lend money to real estate investors. And they're not under the jurisdiction of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was created in the wake of the financial crisis to protect homeowners. These lenders, because they're lending to investors, not to owner-occupants, are not under the same rules. And they lend based on the property, not based on the borrower so much. And so you don't have to qualify as a borrower. The property just, they look and assess the property and see if it's valuable enough. So there is a crack of weakness, a warning flag, I would say, in markets that are more heavily investor markets because of that issue as well.
How then do we look at our market with some sense of, you know, reality for those people who actually live here?
Yeah, I think that is definitely a concern. And when I say Hawaii is affordable, getting back to that too, I think it's affordable historically if we just look at the numbers. But if we dig into the numbers, when I look at the county of Maui, for instance, for people who live there and make the average wages, it's not really affordable. It is just based on its historic standard. I don't know if that really makes sense. But if you're making the average wages in Maui, you would have to spend 93% of your wages to buy a median-priced home. So basically, nobody who's making the average wages or regular workers there are able to afford a home. So I think that is a problem when you have someone who's making the average wages who really cannot. I mean, they have to spend all their income to buy a home. That's not going to happen. Then what you have is that market driven by those outside buyers, and that can become a dangerous place to be because, number one, those buyers do tend to be more fickle. They're not they're not depending on living in the property. And then secondly, you do end up with this very strange scenario where you have properties owned by people who are absent much of the year, and so it trickles down to the local economies.
How concerned are you then that we have third-party buyers coming into Hawaii?
Hawaii would be one of those markets we'd label almost a trophy market, a place where very wealthy outside individuals come in. For the long-term health, I don't think a scenario like that is as good. You need to have more sustainability. You need to have a bigger pool of local buyers who can actually afford to buy the homes.
And just finally, as we look at areas where we've got multi-million-dollar homes, and they, you know, some of them have been falling in value in recent months, what would you tell someone thinking about potentially selling a home like that? Should they hang on to it for a while and try to ride out the next recession?
Oh, yeah, that's a tough one. I think the good news is probably a property like that is going to weather. There will be more volatility, but in a market like Hawaii where land is limited, if this is more about a long-term investment rather than a short-term, then I would try to hold on to that. If it's a short-term investment, then that's a tougher advice to give because that's definitely more speculative in nature and harder to predict.
Well, Wendy, we have people who have been inheriting family homes that they can't afford to live in because the tax structure is too much, or they're just looking at it as not being something that they want for whatever reason, and wondering what do they do with it. It's a really tough call when you don't have a whole lot of inventory.
Yes, yeah, and that's kind of a different scenario than I was thinking of, to be honest. And I think that that actually speaks to the fact that the market is disconnected from. We are in dangerous territory when the home prices get very far disconnected from what people can afford. I would say that it's a great time to be a seller still. Even though we're starting to see some signs in the market of weakness, the bubble has not burst. It's still, in most areas, home prices are continuing to go up. It's still a seller's market because of the lack of inventory. So in that respect, it's a great time to sell. But if there's any way for you to hold on to that property, that's going to be a great asset to have in the long term. It's always very hard to predict this, but based on the cyclical nature of the market, you know, we have 1 to 2 years probably in most areas before we really start to see some of these things come home to roost and prices potentially correct.
And would you say that would include Hawaii?
That would include Hawaii, yes.
All right, Darren, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
Darren Blomquist is a senior vice president at RealtyTrack, a real estate information company and online marketplace for foreclosed and defaulted properties in the U.S. We periodically talk with him about Hawaii's market in the context of national trends. You're listening to Nation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:15. Coming up, an archaeological gathers. Let's go back to that. An archaeologist gathers evidence of pre-contact life on Kauai. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're taking a field trip to a town on the windward coast of Oahu. It lies between Punalu'u and Laie and is known for its beach parks and a shallow reef that extends along the coastline. During the plantation era, sugarcane production was big here and drove the economy. And while it's still considered the country, once upon a time, this area was home to a specific Hawaiian tree, after which it is named. But the name of the town has two parts when it is translated from Hawaiian to English. Can you tell us the name of both the tree and its namesake town? If you're stumped, don't worry. We'll return to our excursion later in the show. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right will get the HPR T-shirt.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Blue Note Hawaii Jazz Club, presenting vocalist and songwriter Joan Osborne in two shows nightly, on stage tonight through July 24th. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Archaeologists who delve into the time before so-called recorded history must operate with whatever clues they can find, and even small amounts of evidence can tell us a great deal. Dr. Jennifer Kahn and her team have been studying a 750-year-old settlement in Mitloli'i on Kauai's Napali coast, learning as they go about the resourcefulness of a population that chose to live on a remote part of the island.
We're focusing on two areas in Mitloli'i. So the first are historic house sites near the mouth of Mitloli'i Stream, so at the front of the valley.
Mm-hmm.
And the second area are along Mitloli'i Beach Flat. We had done some work in January looking for subsurface sites, so sites that you can't see on the surface. And I found what I thought was a rectangular stone platform using an auger, which is sort of like a screwdriver, to get down underneath the surface. And we kept on hitting rocks at the same level. And so we opened up some test pits there, and we found part of what I think might be an enclosure with a very fancy exterior wall. So I think it's part of a potential temple site or heiau. And Tuggle had done a survey of Mitloli'i in the 70s, and she mentions that an informant had said that there might be an agricultural or fishing shrine in Mitloli'i, and we think that we found part of that. So that's pretty exciting.
Was it previously known that there was a community there?
In the valley itself, there are lots of stone-faced agricultural terraces that you can see on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, they're covered in lantana and grass. So there had been a survey done in the 70s, but the maps that were done were sort of schematic. So we know that sites exist, but they're really, up until we started our project in 2009, there had been very little excavation done or any analysis of any of the artifacts or assemblages that came out of previous excavations. So our project is really the first that's outlining the settlement history for Mitloli'i. One of our questions is, when did Hawaiians first arrive in Mitloli'i and first begin to use the resources of Mitloli'i? And then a second question is, to look at how Hawaiians adapted to living in Mililii, because it's a remote place. It has plentiful marine resources, but when you look at Mililii from a water and sunlight perspective, it can be a sort of marginal type of area to grow plants. So we want to date when Hawaiians actually first permanently settled Mililii and what types of innovations or changes they had to make to their daily lives in order to be successful in such a place.
What's the water issue? Is there not enough fresh water available?
So there is a stream in Mililii that does provide fresh water, but it's not a major, major river like Wailua or Waimea.
Mm-hmm.
So that is an issue. They had to really be incredible engineers for their awai to channel the water to their lo'i. And there's also not a lot of flat land to build the lo'i. So the lo'i had to be modified and sort of stepped into the slope. So again, strong engineering skills. And of course, there's other parts of the island where Hawaiians had to use skills like this, but it doesn't have a really nice, beautiful, you know, flat land next to a river like Waimea or Wailua would have had. So a little bit more challenging for agricultural production. We also did a study. We were just there, as I mentioned, in January, and Alan Carpenter of State Park noted to me that we weren't going to be in the sunlight at all. We were going to be in full shade. And that got me thinking, that's another challenge to farmers living in Mililii. So we did an analysis of how much sunlight Mililii gets throughout different times of the year. And during the winter months, Mililii is actually in full shade. Mm. So there's no sunlight for about 3 to 4 months, which meant that lo'i probably would be dormant during those times. But I also have questions about how well breadfruit and other types of crops would have grown in Mililii. So that's another challenge for people living there.
Yeah, and I would think that in your work in general, Jennifer, that you're again and again seeing just how resourceful people can be when conditions demand it, yeah?
I think that that's absolutely correct. I think that Hawaiian communities were really resourceful, and even though Mililii is remote, it had some real benefits. So the fishing is amazing, and it also would have been an interesting place for people to live in because you're a little bit far away from the political centers, and not everybody wanted to be around the watchful ali'i. They wanted to be, you know, some people want to live sort of off the grid or in a more remote location, and there certainly were important adaptations that had to be made, and all the things that we were talking about are some of those things.
One of the things to me that's fascinating about your career is how in archaeology you can operate from relatively few clues to extrapolate a great deal.
I think that's true, and I think that the more data that we have, the more that we know, the better we can flesh out aspects of prehistory. So in Mililii, we're just really starting to work on the beach flat where most of the campers spend their time now. And it's really interesting to me because we dated a site, the state parks had put in a new toilet for the campers about 10 years ago, and they found a deposit there that was about a meter under the surface, so several feet under the surface, deep down. And the deposit had a cooking feature with charcoal as well as a post hole and a stone alignment. So definitely a place where Hawaiians were living in the past. And we dated some of the charcoal from that cooking feature, and the date came out to be AD 1250, so about 750 years ago. Now that is the oldest date that we have for Hawaiians living on the Nepali coast. And I find that date really intriguing because we believe the settlement of Hawaii was about 81,000, about 1,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that people made it out to Mililii relatively early on, even though we're talking about a remote sort of challenging location. So it begins to make us question, what was the draw for Mililii and why were Hawaiians out there so early? And we're just beginning to be able to piece together parts of this puzzle, as you mentioned, using our small data sets. But as I gain more data, I'm going to be able to flesh out what this early occupation of Mililii looked like. Was it just a temporary sort of fishing camp? Or does it look like it was more permanent? And if it was more permanent, then I find that very intriguing that we have such an early settlement along the Nepali coast.
Definitely. And it also makes you wonder if they were going to something or away from something, as you alluded earlier.
I think that's very true. I think there were pushes and pulls that would have led Hawaiians to live in different parts of the island. And a lot of the archaeological models sort of stress the power of the elites, the power of the chiefs, and how through time they needed more surplus and more agriculture, so you'd have agricultural expansion into these more marginal zones. But the fact that we have this early date for use of Mililii sort of turns that model on its head and makes us think about what was the agency of those Hawaiians that chose to go out to Mililii. Maybe it was their choice rather than a push factor from the elite. So I find those kinds of questions, looking at sort of choices and reasons why ancient Hawaiians made certain decisions in the past, I find that really intriguing.
Dr. Jennifer Kahn will talk story this evening at 6 p.m. in the Kauai Museum Courtyard. Her subject is Understanding Variability of Settlement and Subsistence in Ancient Mililii, Nepali, Kauai. Admission is free.
His debut album won 6 Hoku Awards and his recently released second is full of mele and memories of people and places he loves. On July 23rd in the Atherton studio, experience Hawaiian music played in the real new style by Hoku Zudermeister. Tickets at hprtickets.org or at 955-8821 during business hours. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Do you tune into Hawaii Public Radio for the national and international coverage we carry? Well, you're not the only one. Listeners in other parts of the country and the world come to HPR for news, information, and the music of Hawaii. Many thanks to Jennifer Lee of Beaverton, Oregon, Melanie Andes of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and Richard Yetter of Lompoc, California. Think globally, act locally, and become an HPR member. Call us at 955-8821 during business hours or find out more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Mark Berwick from the Honolulu Cricket Club. And you're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
There's still no deal to help union workers displaced by the privatization of Maui hospitals. The talks continue, and so does the special legislative session. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us now with a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Okay, so just to recap here a little bit, this is all because the governor had vetoed SB 2077. He said it was overly generous to the workers. There was concern that it could harm the tax-exempt status of the employees' retirement system, and also that it would greatly add to the unfunded liabilities of the state. But is this really pitting, you know, the governor and the administration against legislators?
On the surface, I think both the lawmakers and the governor say that they share the same goal, which is to settle this dispute between the United Public Workers. Of course, they have employees there at those three hospitals, two on Maui, one on Lanai. Hawaii Government Employees Association is involved as well with their own employees. But on the surface, they're presenting a shared front. We want to settle this. Behind the scenes, they can't seem to reach an agreement on this legislation. So the legislature is trying to amend that bill that the governor vetoed. But meanwhile, the governor is continuing his own negotiations with UPW. The two are connected. But some are complaining yesterday, well, why don't we just let the governor keep going on with these negotiations? They seem like they may be making progress. Why does the legislature have to intervene? Well, others in the legislature say we have to. There is a contract with the state that the UPW has. We need to honor that. They, too, want to settle this and go forward.
And of the there's simply the matter of the bill itself and what the legislature is going to do about that. Yes, he's vetoed it, but this is supposed to be a process. How much, do you have any sense about, you know, how much of the Senate, how much of the House really feels that they should be hands-off?
I think a lot of the members simply don't know what's going on other than they've been asked to be there in special session. Many of them would like to be running for re-election. As you know, there's a primary coming up in a couple of weeks here. It's really at the top levels of the leadership that are working on this amended version. The lead seems to be from the House in particular because Joe Suki, the Speaker, represents Maui. But there are senators from Maui as well that are very concerned about their home island. And so they're trying to come up with a compromise bill. Currently, Scott Sike, the majority leader, is talking about $25 million in severance pay. That's down from the $40 million that was initially being bandied about. But they would drop that special retirement package, that thing that would have triggered the concerns about the ERS. So they do seem to be reaching some language that that could fit with what the governor is looking for as well. But the governor seems so focused right now on trying to work through this settlement that he hasn't even – I mean, frankly, we haven't even seen the bill yet. They haven't even voted on the amended language. Nobody, at least with the exception of a few lawmakers, has actually seen what they are trying to compromise on.
Which makes it a little bit tough to talk about, but the bottom line of it is if this comes through in a way that the governor doesn't like, he could veto that one too.
Yes, he could, or he could let it become law. He could sign it. Having said this, if there's a settlement in the next few days, and there does seem some progress being made, a settlement with the state and the UPW, then that would effectively probably make moot the whole purpose of the legislation. But we'll see. There's so much going on, so many moving parts. I think the governor said it best. This is a very complex situation. He doesn't think there's ever been one quite comparable in terms of all the variables that are involved, labor, the legislature, the government, so many different things.
Which makes it really interesting to be watching and talking about. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Petha.
We'll talk to you in the morning. Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
A stage that can handle everything from millions of balloons to Clint Eastwood's famous chair.
There's always that fear that the candidate will come in and ask for something that is impossible to do.
Staging the RNC without upstaging the candidate. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Good morning, I'm Chris Vandercook. At 8:33, you're tuned to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. You can get in touch with us through our talkback line at 808-792-8217. On Facebook, you can find us at Hawaii Conversation, or on Twitter at HI Conversation. And you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up, we'll hear from Neil Conan and later what island life does to a person. But first, this news from Deutsche Welle.
DW Deutsche Welle News.
This is Shea Meineke in Bonn. At least four people were injured on a train near Würzburg in southern Germany after a teenager went on a stabbing rampage on Monday night. Police have identified the man as a 17-year-old Afghan who had been living in Ochsenfurt, Germany, with a foster family for some time. Media reported that he had shouted Allah Akbar as he attacked passengers with an axe and a knife, and that he had come to Germany as an asylum seeker. Bavaria's Interior Ministry confirmed the suspect had been shot dead by police. The four victims were from Hong Kong. The train route between Ochsenfurt and Würzburg has been temporarily closed. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has warned Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan of the consequences of reinstating the death penalty as Turkey reels from a failed coup attempt. Erdogan has been cracking down on people suspected of attempting to overthrow the government that led to the deaths of hundreds of people and left the country in shock. International observers fear Erdogan might reinstate the death penalty, which was abolished in Turkey in 2004 and would go against the European Convention on Human Rights. Erdogan told CNN in an interview on Monday that it was liable to say he was cracking down on dissidents. A French prosecutor said on Monday that the Bastille Day atrocity in the southern city of Nice was of a premeditated nature. The country is still reeling from the massacre, in which 84 people were run down after a man drove his truck through a crowd along the beach. The prosecutor said at a press conference that the driver had recently developed an interest in radical Islam and had planned the attack several days in advance. However, the prosecutor also emphasized that there was no evidence as of now that the attacker had a connection to any known terror group. Shortly after the massacre, the so-called Islamic State claimed responsibility for the attack. Theresa May announced on Monday that she will make Germany her first foreign visit as the UK's new prime minister, followed by France. Chancellor Angela Merkel will receive May in Berlin on Wednesday, where the two plan to discuss Britain's decision to leave the EU. The two leaders will also discuss their country's bilateral relationship, as well as political developments in Turkey. May will then travel to France to meet with President François Hollande in Paris. May was the UK's interior minister for 6 years before running for the leadership of the country's Conservative Party. She succeeds David Cameron. Seoul said on Tuesday that North Korea had launched three ballistic missiles, the latest in a spate of such launches since Pyongyang conducted a nuclear test in January. South Korean military officials said the missiles flew between 500 and 600 kilometers, far enough to strike anywhere in the country. The news comes amid rising tensions in the region after the U.S. and South Korea announced they would go ahead with an anti-missile system on the peninsula. Earlier in the week, North Korea warned it would take physical action against the two countries following their announcement. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. Shay Meineke, Deutsche Welle News.
The first day of the Republican convention began with fratricide and ended with plagiarism. In between, speakers painted a dark picture of an American under attack from forces within and without. Turkey, a country where such forces are very real, continues to purge the military and police after an attempted coup. And after last week's court ruling in favor of the Philippines, the world waits for the other shoe to drop in the South China Sea. Those are just some of the stories on the minds of news analyst Neil Conan, who returns today, as he does most Tuesdays, not quite back on his mat at farm, but closer, at least in Los Angeles today. So welcome almost home. Hi, Neil.
Thanks very much, Beth Ann. I get back to the Big Island tomorrow.
Okay, that's good news. Now, before we get to the controversy over Melania Trump's speech, I got to ask you about the overall tenor of the convention in Cleveland. I mean, there was pretty light on ideology, nothing really of policy, but very heavy on emotion. Rudy Giuliani was whipping him up just into a frenzy, and there were those dark and scary pictures painted of America. What's the real message here?
I think what we're seeing is sort of an extreme form of two very familiar American political campaigns. One of which is throw the bums out. Those other guys have been in power too long. They're taking us down the road to perdition. It's time for a change. The other is we're not them. Whatever you think of us, those other guys are much worse. To be fair, I think we'll hear a fair bit of that next week in Philadelphia too. That whatever we do can't possibly put Trump in power. And that's interesting. That first argument has a very strong basis in history. No political party has managed to hold on to the White House after a two-term presidency since World War II, except once, and that was when George H.W. Bush followed Ronald Reagan. And, of course, Bush was a one-term president.
Okay, so when you bring up Ronald Reagan, though, there are calls to mind of his rather sunny outlook, quite optimistic. You know, remember, it's morning in America. Our best days are ahead of us. That's a long way, though, from the dystopia that speakers described yesterday in Cleveland.
That's true. But that darker view, I think, jibes very well with the anger and frustration of so many voters in the Republican base, the people who chose Donald Trump. What we don't know is whether that can expand to include a lot of independents and even some Democrats, not to mention the sizable fraction of Republicans who say, at least right now, that they can't bring themselves to vote for a candidate who said so many, you know, ugly things about minorities and women.
That one inclusive speech last night, the one speaker who did reach out was the candidate's wife. But practically before the applause faded, her message was just so overwhelmed when it became clear that, you know, parts of those speech had been lifted almost verbatim, you know, from the speech that Michelle Obama delivered as a candidate's wife 8 years ago.
And, you know, it's going to be a major distraction today and maybe all week. Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort told CNN, you know, basically, you know, it just didn't happen. It's absurd to think that they would crib from Michelle Obama. And certainly he said there's no feeling on her part, Melania, that she did it. And I guess that's not quite a denial. My favorite, though, was Chris Christie, who said 93% of her speech was completely different from Michelle's. I don't know where he got that number. It might even be right. But then again, the parts of her speech that were identical were the sections on honesty, character, and integrity. This is a long way from being explained away, and we have yet to see how Mr. Trump is going to respond to what he may see as the humiliation of his wife.
Which is going to go on and on, especially as they're playing those speeches next to each other and then on top of each other. Anyway, we're going to stay tuned for all that. I want to ask you, though, about a couple of the international stories, including that extraordinary drama that started to play out last Friday in Turkey, where at least some parts of the military tried to overthrow the government. Hundreds of people were killed and injured, and now thousands have been arrested. What do you
think? Turkey has a long history of military takeovers. President Erdogan and his AK party, it's an Islamist party, not an extreme Islamist party, but they have long suspected the soldiers wanted to throw them out, and he worked very hard to remove those he suspected of disloyalty, to the point where he was accused of, you know, paranoia. Now, I don't mean to dismiss the casualties and the many thousands who will lose their jobs over this. Of course, many will be in prison, too. But now Erdogan gets the gift of having been right all along in the form of a coup so ineptly staged that some people think he might have done it himself.
And there's been a lot of talk of that, but is there really any evidence?
No. Then again, there's no evidence of the involvement of the exiled cleric who Erdogan is blaming either. That's a man named Gulen who lives in the Poconos in Pennsylvania. Erdogan blames him for, you know, pulling the strings and demands the United States extradite him to Turkey.
What did these plotters do wrong, though?
Just about everything. They didn't have anything like unanimous support in the military. They did not have a plan to make it look as if they did have broad-based support. And then they violated the very first rule of coup d'etats, which was laid out by Machiavelli all those years ago. And that's if you strike at the prince, don't miss. That's actually a paraphrase of Machiavelli from Ralph Waldo Emerson, of all people. But the coup plotters did not arrest Erdogan. They did not kill him. He went on social media to call his supporters into the streets. And shortly after that, the coup collapsed.
Now, I can't let you go without asking you about the South China Sea. We talked about that the last time. But since then, an international court has handed a sweeping victory to the Philippines and thrown out China's claim to the entire area. So what happens next?
Well, as we talked about, China refused to participate in those proceedings. Beijing argues the court has no jurisdiction and it will not abide by the ruling. And nobody is going to be trying to push China off its artificial islands in the Spratlys in the South China Sea or push away Chinese fishing boats or the Chinese Navy. Nobody wants a war here. But this is very important. It bolsters the court decision bolsters the Philippines, Vietnam, Malaysia, and recently Indonesia has gotten drawn into this. All countries who see the Chinese as bullies trying to expand their territory. It's a major loss for China, where every school child is taught that these waters and these islands belong to China since the Ming Dynasty. The situation is really very unstable right now. It would be easy to see somebody acting to assert what they see as their rights. In fact, I think it's only a matter of time before somebody does something provocative. Who and what and when and where will all be important, and it's worth noting that the professional heads of the United States and Chinese navies are meeting in China this week with the South China Sea at the top of the agenda.
All right. For the moment, we're going to leave it there, but you're going to be home next week?
Hey, those Mac nuts don't pick themselves.
You could ask for some help, and I bet you'd get it from a lot of people. Have a good trip back and
okay,
a safe
thanks,
one. Bethan. We'll check in next week. News analyst Neil Conan joins us most Tuesdays from his MacNut farm. You can also hear his Pacific News Minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio. Earlier, we paid a visit to the windward coast of Oahu in search of a little town that was once known for its sugarcane production and now famous for its beach parks and coastline. We asked you to name this little town in the area and the tree after which the town is named. Now, once there were many of these trees in the area. Its flowers start out yellow, later deepen to orange, and finally turn bright red by the time they fall. The introduction of sugarcane production changed all that and drastically reduced the number of living hau trees in the town of Haula, which means red hau in reference to those beautiful eye-catching red flowers.
And Bethann, Judith Wilhoit of Kailua knew the answer, so she'll be getting an HPR t-shirt. And at 8:46, that's today's quiz. If you've got a quiz for us, do send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
The idea of living on a remote island is an element of people's fantasies all over the world, based on some vague notion of the ways it'll change us. Jason Blake is a writer and longtime Kauai resident who acted on his fantasy when he moved to the Garden Isle and then made an effort to define just how it had changed him. His book is 10 Things I Learned Living on an Island, and he's on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
I imagine there are a great many harried city dwellers right now thinking, you know, sort of leaning back at their desk and daydreaming about doing this someday, going to live on a place like Kauai.
Yeah, and not without its challenges, at least in the first few years either.
Well, is that how it worked for you?
Yeah, I mean, I moved here from Chicago about 12 years ago, mm-hmm. and you know, you definitely have an idea of what it will be and the stress that it will relieve. And some of that comes true over the long term, and then there's lots of little wake-up calls along the way. But I think the biggest point of the book is that, you know, Bhutan has the idea of gross national happiness. Well, island living has this, you said it very well, has some definable characteristics. It really wouldn't be a bad thing for us to focus on exporting as well as tourism. We have a way of getting along. We have a way of appreciating nature and taking care of our friends and family and neighbors, things that really, they weren't commonplace. Even growing up in the South and living in Chicago, there's kind of a sweetness, even with our traffic, even with our development issues, even with our politics. There is an underlying sweetness, and I think most people who live in Hawaii long-term kind of can't imagine living here, living anyplace else. You know, since everybody can't move here, wouldn't it be nice if we could at least share a little bit of that spirit with the rest of the world?
Well, Jason, as a former city dweller, and I'm one myself, you feel in a city that a lot of the tensions among people come from just being too close to too many people, you know, not unable to walk down the street without stepping in and around crowds.
Sure, sure. And I think that's true, but I also think that there are things that we do here that relieve the pressure from that, even when it gets crowded. You know, people naturally go to enjoy the outdoors. They naturally, you know, in Kauai, you can drive around on Friday night and see garage doors open and people sitting, drinking beer and playing ukulele and stuff like that. We make an effort to keep that underlying tension from spilling over into ways that create, you know, hostility in the bank line at the grocery store. And it's a little different in Honolulu, but even beeping, even honking your horn is taboo on Kauai. And I think part of that is we lose a recognition that, you know, we have to mind being together in a small space too.
You know, Jason, when I go back to mainland city, I often feel that it is filled with people who get upset over what I would consider nothing.
I totally agree. And, you know, I can even see the shadow of myself, like when I used to live there, you know. Mm-hmm. Here I can stand in Starbucks and think, boy, 10 years ago this would have made me crazy that I had to wait for 10 minutes. Now we just kind of talk to each other and wave at friends that we know because we bump into people we know in the grocery store here. It's just different, yeah. And you go to the mainland, and so I actually had a trip to London, and you know, in the tube, people don't even make eye contact, and my friend and I were just kind of smiling at each other just because the absurdity to some of it too. You know, you appreciate a lot of that when you live in a quirky place.
Well, my latest experience on the New York City subway, everybody was staring at an iPhone.
That's true. That wasn't the case when we went to London. People were just pretty much, looking at nothing, almost looking down, looking maybe at a paper, maybe at their phone. But yeah, there wasn't as much tablet immersion in Europe as there is even here in our schools, I think.
What made you decide to take these changes that had come about in you and make a book out of them?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say how stuff like that comes about. I've been a journaler for a long time, so part of the way I keep my sanity is that I journal every morning. And, you know, I realize these kind of, I mean, they're really trite from a certain point of view, but there's a real fine line between trite and profound, you know?
Yes, there is.
Simple spiritual truth or trite. And, you know, these things just kind of kept popping up in my morning pages about what was happening to me over time living here and these kind of aha moments I had that were really things you know intellectually, but you don't necessarily live them. And I just started to track them, and eventually the idea of the book came, and I thought, well, people do love Hawaii, and there is this mystery about it, and not everybody can live here or will live here or wants to move here, but I think there is always an attraction about Hawaii and island living and what if, and while it's not without its challenges, there is a real grace to it, and you know, I think everybody who lives in Hawaii hopes that everybody in the world will move here, so maybe if we can explore part of that aloha and feeling that it certainly can't hurt the planet.
You know, I've heard people with situations similar to yours say, I think that because I moved here, I'm actually going to live longer because I've learned how to kind of slow my heart rate and relax. Do you feel that a little bit?
I absolutely feel that. I feel, you know, the like just even the necessity of shoes. Shoes were a major ordeal in this city. You had which shoes on which day of work, and then in Chicago, if it was snowing, you had to figure out, you know, which pair of shoes you were going to ride, like wear into the snow, and which pair you'd have at workplace, and what if you exercise? That was another pair. Here, I'm like, where I need a pair of shoes because I have to go to a meeting. Where is my one pair of dress shoes? And so materialism too. Not that I still don't like nice things, but I certainly don't need as many of them as I did when I lived in the city.
Well, it sounds as if the things that you talk about in your book are one thing, the effect of being close to nature, right?
Sure, nature, taking care of friends, being a part of your community. The way that the past hurricanes hang over the islands and that people really do kind of hunker down together even when there's a tsunami warning, and I think that spills over into our everyday life. You're not, even if we don't like somebody on Kauai, we're not too mean to them because we might need water from them in a natural emergency. I mean, That's not, if I had to say there was one underlying message to the book, is that we kind of do our best to get along here, even with all of our human insanities. And it's not, it was a lot of other voices saying a lot of other different things in the world right now. So if Hawaii can be the reminder to just get along a little more, I'm all okay with that.
You came to Kauai after Hurricane Iniki, right?
Yes, yes.
But, I mean, obviously you felt its after effects because
it's still really culturally here. I mean, everybody who's lived here at least 20, 25 years, they talk about it. We still have a few properties that are still damaged, the Coco Palms probably being the most famous. And it's really a reference point for the people that live here. And, areas of the island are referenced in time, pre-Iniki, post-Iniki. People talk about the changes that happened on the island. They talk about what happened with development. They talk about who chose to stay, who chose to leave.
Got people, I think, one thing that you hit on, Jason, is it got people helping each other. And
exactly.
And thank you very much for taking the time this morning.
Hey, thanks. Have a great day.
You bet. Jason Blake is the author of 10 Things I Learned Living on an Island, published by Lake Press. And you can learn more about him and his work on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Hi, my name's Rick Nakashima from Ruby Tuesday, Hawaii, and I'm proud to be an underwriter of Hawaii Public Radio. I've had some great experiences as an underwriter for HPR. I get compliments all the time, people coming up and saying, we heard you're helping out HPR. So I'm real proud Ruby Tuesday, Hawaii can be part of this and help HPR in their underwriting.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting, your message heard here. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Beth Ann, I just want to clarify that 93% of the words I said today on the show
were
my own, yes. As to which 7%, you're just going to have to figure that out.
You weren't going to leave that alone, were you?
How could you leave that alone? I mean, it's too beautiful. But, the whole thing of plagiarism, I grew up in a writer's family where plagiarism was a form of treason, and it really does seem as if standards have eroded as to what constitutes plagiarism.
I mean, certainly there's a case to be made that there are certain ideas that people have and they may be more universal, but how they're expressed certainly shouldn't be word for word from someone else's. Unless,
no.
Of course, you're quoting them, but that wasn't being done yesterday, was it?
No, not exactly.
All right. Well, you are free to quote us if you really like to. Otherwise, be in touch with us and be back here tomorrow morning. Representative Chris Lee will be here to take a look at what's next for HECO after the collapse of the Next Era deal.
And look inside the Diamond Head Theater production of Mamma Mia.
We like to hear from you, and you can call our talk back line anytime you like and leave us your comments. The number is 808-792-8217. Please just make sure you leave us your name and the town from which you're calling. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the conversation page, along with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under talk shows for the conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning with the conversation.